Hello and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Reviews. We're your hosts, Matt Levine.
And Vincent Hanna.
And we are talking about all of our favorite monster movies, the good, the bad, and the downright campy, and asking if they stand the test of time. Traditional kaiju, creature features, space invaders, the supernatural, and everything in between. All strange beasts welcome here. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. Thank you all so much for hanging out, listening to this episode. Today we're going to talk about maybe the best worst movie, we'll get into that in a little bit, of all time, Troll 2. Tonight we also have a recurring guest star in Camp Kaiju joining us, Frank Olson. Welcome, Frank.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for coming back.
Yes, glad to be here to talk about one of the true greats.
This was your request as a patron.
Yes, that's right. Yes. I actually forgot about that, to be honest. But yeah, I think this was one of the ones that I put up there.
It's a good message for all of you current patrons or would-be patrons. Feel free to like let us know if there are any titles that you want us to bring to the podcast. We definitely would love to hear what you think. You can send us an email at campkaiju@gmail.com or just comment on our Instagram page.
It is camp_kaiju.
Yeah.
Just Google it and you'll find it, probably.
Yeah, honestly.
Yeah. But yeah, let us know. Vincent, what do we have coming up in the podcast?
A couple things. So we have the next coming up, The Day of the Triffids from 1963, I believe. A British horror film about killer plants. Matt, that's your pick. So let me know if I'm off base there.
No, that's true as far as I know. I actually haven't seen the movie yet. I think it's from, when is the movie? Yeah, 63, you're right.
Okay, great.
We have a motif about plants and vegetation on Camp Kaiju coming up, so pretty exciting. Yeah.
Following that will be The Toxic Avenger, the cult 80s film. And speaking of plant exploitation on Camp Kaiju, little did I know, Troll 2 fits right into that. With plants and body horror and some gnarly stuff.
Yeah, indeed. Yes, we'll definitely get into that soon. Also, big news for Vincent, you have a play coming up in the Twin Cities Horror Festival.
Yeah, just real quick, Twin Cities Horror Festival is playing October 19th through the 29th in Minneapolis. My play that I wrote, it's a one act about a killer hand exploitation. And we'd love to see you all there October 20th. That's a Friday night at 6:30 p.m. You can find information on our website, campkaijumoviereviews.com. For our patrons out there, Jason, Kelly, Peggy, and our anonymous patron, we'd love to see your faces that night or any night you can make it. It's all good. But yeah, thank you for the support. And we look forward to having a bloody good time.
Nice. I'm very excited for the play. I also just realized that Troll 2 also has a scene in which somebody's hand is cut off. So it all connects on Camp Kaiju.
Oh my God.
So Troll 2, as we mentioned, this was Frank's recommendation. So Frank, what is your history with this movie?
So I was actually trying to remember the other day how exactly my brother and I first saw it. I know that he and I saw it together. I couldn't remember if he had like already seen it and was like, oh my God, you've got to see this, you know? but it was definitely when we were teenagers. And so I texted him to ask him and he couldn't remember either. But, you know, back in the day, he used to just rent like, you know, any horror movie that came out. We used to live pretty much right across the street from a Blockbuster. And there was another store in West Bend at that time called Video Plus that was just a couple blocks away from us, too. So we probably rented it at one place or the other. I don't know if, you know, he rented it knowing that this was like a notoriously like bad, crazy movie, or if he just you know, rented it on a whim. He's like, it's something in the horror section he hasn't seen before. But I do remember, you know, watching it the first time and just kind of being amazed by it and sort of like hypnotized by how bizarre, you know, just utterly bizarre it is, like in ways that don't even seem intentional. So it's a fascinating movie.
Yeah, it is kind of awe-inspiring in its own way, for sure.
Did you say hypnotizing, Frank?
Yes.
I love that word to describe this movie. Yep.
So, Vincent, this was your first time seeing it, right?
It was, but, you know, my first encounter with this movie, I think maybe for many people of our generation, us millennials who grew up with internet culture in the mid-2000s, when there's a great meme, the clip of the famous, "Oh my God." And I laughed at that so much at 16 years old. And I never knew what movie it was from until recently. I was like, oh, Troll 2. Okay. Oh, let's do it for the podcast. Perfect. And the movie is so much sweeter than just that one line. That is just like one delicious part of this cake, of this green dyed troll cake.
New band name, Green Dye Troll Cake, I call it.
Sorry, I watched it last weekend and I followed up with Troll 1, which I know has nothing to do with Troll 2, but I'd love to talk about that movie too at some point on this podcast, because I think that is also a hell of a good time in its own way.
I have to confess, I've never seen Troll 1.
Got Julia Louis-Dreyfus in it. Yeah, I saw it once years ago. It's definitely, it's not the same type of experience as Troll 2, but it is I do remember it being fairly entertaining. I also remember that was going back to video stores again. I remember I used to be really afraid when I was a really little kid of the like poster and video box art for that one. Which was just like the little troll guy, I think, holding up like a some sort of like spherical thing. I'm not sure what it was supposed to be, but I do remember being like genuinely frightened of that when I was like 5 or whatever, you know.
Just real quick, I had the same experience with the box art of Jack Frost. It was like a holographic thing. The days of like truly inspired box art. Love those days.
I love this like trip down memory lane to like actual video stores. It's great. I was not expecting this, but yeah. Frank and I both grew up in West Bend, Wisconsin, so the shout out to Video Plus especially like hits close to my heart.
Yeah.
I had the Video King in Kissimmee, Florida.
Wow, that's a good name. Yeah, so my experience with this film, I feel like I saw it maybe like 15 years ago. And I think like a lot of people, I just kind of heard through the grapevine how like ridiculous and like surreal, like just like bizarrely unique it is. So yeah, I have seen it a couple times before, but it never gets old. And yeah, Vincent, you're totally right. Like that famous meme is one of the best parts of this movie, but there are a couple other lines that I like more. So I'm sure we'll talk about that pretty soon.
Yeah. Yep.
Well, we can probably jump into the plot synopsis. I did, you know, for all you listeners out there, I did try to cut this down as much as possible, but this plot is just so beautiful. There are some things you cannot cut. So bear with us for a little bit.
They're eating her. And then they're going to eat me.
Sorry, I'm just thinking of some really funny lines that I also love. Okay. Synopsis. I'm first. Okay, the Waits family is about to head to the quaint farming community of, and let me ask you gentlemen, Nilbog or Nilbog?
Nilbog, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nilbog spelled backwards is... All right, the farming community of Nilbog for a month to enjoy some peace and quiet in the countryside. The night before they're set to leave, young Joshua is visited by the ghost of his dead grandpa, Seth, warning him that goblins want to transform him and the family into plants so they can eat them. Meanwhile, Joshua's sister, Holly, enjoys a rigorous workout and is visited by her boyfriend, Elliot, who joins the family on their visit to Nilbog along with his friends.
They arrive in Nilbog and meet the Presents family, whose house they'll be staying at. The Presents have left the Waits a feast of food filled with mysterious green goo. Believing that the goo is poison left by goblins, Joshua prevents his family from eating the food by pissing all over it. And I'll just interject here and say that that was the moment that I knew this was a special movie the first time I was watching it. One of Elliot's friends, Arnold, goes for a walk and sees a girl being chased by goblins. Arnold and the girl flee to a church in the woods where they encounter the Goblin Queen, a druid witch named Credence Leonore Gielgud. Credence tricks the girl into drinking a magic potion, which dissolves her into a vegetable slime that the goblins eat.
The next morning, Joshua and his father, Michael, head into town to buy some food. Joshua wanders to a nearby church and sees a sermon underway. The Reverend preaches about the evils of eating meat to the congregants, who are actually goblins in human form. Later, at the Presence house, the Waits family discovers that the townspeople have prepared them a surprise party to apologize for the events at the church. Credence arrives in Joshua's room through his mirror and attacks him, but the ghost of Grandpa Seth reappears and chops off Credence's hand with an axe. Credence magically returns to her chapel and transforms herself into a beautiful woman. She then goes to Elliot's RV and seduces another of his friends, Brent, whom she feeds corn on the cob before drowning him in popcorn.
Back at the party, the evil Reverend is killed by a Molotov cocktail. Partygoers then turn against the Waits, revealing themselves to be goblins and trapping the Waits inside the house. The Waits family, along with Elliot, hold a seance to conjure Seth once again. Grandpa Seth returns and offers Joshua a bag with a secret weapon to use against the goblins, who break into the house and start attacking the family. Joshua is magically transported to the Goblin Queen's lair, where he reveals what's in the bag, a double-decker bologna sandwich. He devours it, making him poisonous to the goblins, and it touches the magical Stonehenge stone in the church, which destroys all of the goblins. Or does it? Double-decker bologna sandwich.
That part is great. Looks so gross. And then, of course, there's like a twist ending that truly must be seen to be believed, which we will not ruin here.
Yeah, right. No spoilers.
Yeah.
Nilbog! It's goblin spelled backwards! This is their kingdom!
Yeah, I mean, this movie is nuts. The plot is totally illogical. It's all over the place. It makes no sense. And yet, yeah, I mean, like, Frank, hypnotic is the right word for it. You can't take your eyes off the screen. So let's talk about the cast and crew a little bit. The film was directed by Claudio Fragasso under the pseudonym Drake Floyd, which is a pretty great pseudonym. Apparently, Claudio Fragasso started as a director of art films in the 1970s. This is based on the research that I read. I am dubious how artistic they are, but it's certainly possible. Fragasso was then a co-director or assistant director, depending on who you ask, of Italian genre films like Hell of the Living Dead, Women's Prison Massacre, Violence in a Women's Prison, Rats, Night of Terror, Robo-War, and Cop Game. Those are just a few of the titles that I saw in his filmography.
Good titles.
Yeah.
Yeah, Robo-War and Cop Game sound like they were just like generated by Chat GPT or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm intrigued by how Women's Prison Massacre and Violence in a Women's Prison are different. They sound like the exact same movie. So. Be a good double feature, maybe.
Are you guys familiar with the behind-the-scenes documentary that was made of this movie?
Yes. In fact, I just rewatched it yesterday. I hadn't realized that I'd already seen it, and then halfway through I was like, oh, I recognize a lot of the stuff. But yeah, I've seen it twice now.
Pretty good, right?
Yeah, it's entertaining. Definitely, you know, a lot of people on the cast and crew are interesting characters. Some of them kind of seem like they're not that different than they appear in the movie, which is kind of amazing. But like particularly the mom of the main family has that same like strange, glassy, faraway look in her eyes in real life as she does in the movie.
Yeah. I don't want to. Yeah, I actually have some other thoughts about the documentary as a whole. But regardless, That's great, because most of my knowledge about like the production history and everything comes from that documentary, Best Worst Movie. So just wanted to throw that out there.
Yeah, and I haven't actually seen that movie in quite a while. I feel like it's maybe been like 10 years or something since I've seen it. It came out in 2009, I think. So I don't remember it all that well, but I do remember, yeah, just being fascinated by the people that appear in it and just like how, I don't know, you know, the stars seem to align in the making of this movie and bringing together like a very strange and like singular group of people. One of many reasons it's, you know, so enduring. Yeah, so we will get to that documentary a little bit more in a while here, but just to kind of continue with the making of the film a little bit of Troll 2. So even though Drake Floyd was credited as screenwriter, it was actually Fragasso's wife, Rosella Drudy, who wrote a lot of the film. She wrote the script to begin with. Fragasso did do a lot of rewrites on the film, but it was basically her project or her screenplay to begin with.
Cinematography is by Giancarlo Ferrando, who shot many low-budget Italian exploitation films, and I just had to read this, including the 1973 film Torso, which Quentin Tarantino inexplicably loves. Although, Matt, you think it's pretty terrible.
This was my aside in the notes. I don't understand why Tarantino loves that movie so much because it's kind of just like a sleazy Italian horror movie. But it was an unexpected connection that I saw there. I think this cinematographer, Giancarlo Ferrando, you know, he shot like hundreds of low budget Italian movies throughout the years. So I'm sure a couple of them are worth watching, I would imagine.
Troll 2.
Yeah, exactly.
I was thinking when I rewatched this, it's not really like a poorly shot movie. I mean, there's definitely a lot of other bad production values in it, but it looks somewhat professionally done, I would say, on the level of cinematography at least.
Yeah, I would agree. There are some like bizarre handheld shots that like look really kind of skewed with like things in the foreground seeming like really immense and things in the background seeming kind of minuscule by comparison. So yeah, it's not bad looking in that way at least. It is bad looking in some other ways, but I did want to talk about the producers a little bit because I think this is kind of interesting background. So Troll 2 was co-produced by Edouard Sarlouis, with whom Claudio Fragasso had worked on the 1986 film Monster Dog, starring Alice Cooper. All I know about this movie is that it's a werewolf movie starring Alice Cooper, so of course I want to see that immediately. Sarlouis also took his name off of Troll 2 because he was not very proud of it, so that's at least one person who did not want to be featured in the credits. The other producer is Joe D'Amato. He's the head of the production company, Filmarage. He's kind of like a notorious producer in the history of Italian cinema. He produced hundreds and hundreds of low-budget, cheap exploitation movies. The Emmanuel series of like softcore erotic movies are some of them that he produced, which we'll talk about a little bit more. So yeah, this guy Joe D'Amato like was, you know, was blunt in his opinion that like movies are meant to make money. The entertainment value and the artistic value is kind of irrelevant for him. So, you know, I mean, that's kind of like the impetus of the movie, I guess, but thankfully, it went in some weirder and more kind of memorable directions than he probably anticipated it would.
Fascinating.
The music is by Carlo Murillo Cordio. Pretty much all the music was done on a pair of synthesizers, which is very easy to tell from listening to the soundtrack. And then finally, the costumes in Troll 2 were designed by Laura Gemser, who played Emmanuel in that series of softcore erotic films in the 70s. And I don't think she really had a background in costume design. I think she kind of just was a member of Joe D'Amato's production company from their collaboration on those films. Interestingly, she was one of the few crew members who spoke English. Most of the other crew members spoke Italian or like a very broken kind of English that was hard to communicate to the actors in. So, yeah, we'll get more into the chaotic sort of production of the film momentarily. But yeah, do you guys want to talk about any of the cast members at all?
So George Hardy plays Michael, who's the father. He was a dentist who had no prior acting experience, but he showed up at the casting call on a whim and wound up being in, arguably the lead role. And he's also kind of the protagonist of that documentary, Best Worst Movie, that Vincent mentioned earlier. Definitely one of the most interesting figures in it. Kind of a guy who has a successful dentist practice, but always dreamed of, being an entertainer.
playing his son in the movie, and actually the director of that Doc Best Worst movie is Michael Stevenson. He plays young Joshua, the young boy in the movie, and he has directed several other documentaries and narrative movies. So actually kind of one of the few actors in Troll 2 who went on then to pursue or have success in the film industry. This is the general store owner. Frank, do you want to talk about Don Packard?
Sure. Yeah. He was in and out of a mental institution around the time that the movie was being made, but he was allowed some sort of a break from the institution. And during that break, he was allowed to film his scenes or something where they were off for, you know, a day or two in the week. And that's when he had to shoot all of his scenes. And he also mentions in the movie that he smoked an enormous amount of marijuana before filming and didn't really know what was happening. Yeah, there's one part in the documentary where he talks about how, you know, in a scene where he's trying to sort of force feed the young kid Joshua some of the green goblin goo stuff that turns them into vegetables, that he felt like he really wanted to kill him. So you get, yeah, he's an example of one of the people who seems to be maybe not all that far off from the very weird character that he plays in the movie.
Yeah, that guy's a trip. I mean, a very sincere man, but he says he really wanted to kill Michael Stevenson on the shoot of that movie.
Yeah, and the way he describes in the documentary makes it seem like he does not understand that, you know, Michael Stevenson was the guy who was directing it and probably who he was talking to when he said right. that he really wanted to kill the kid.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was an interesting moment for sure.
The moment in Troll 2 where one of Elliot's friends is like talking to this character, the Don Packard character. And I think he asks if he has any bacon or something like that. And Don Packard. Yeah, exactly. Just like a totally exaggerated, like, it's maybe my favorite part of the movie. I love it.
Agreed.
Very bizarre. Frank, I was going to ask, do you mind talking a little bit more about Margot Prey, who plays the mom in this movie? Because I remember there's something really interesting about her in that Best Worst Movie documentary, but I haven't seen it in a while, and I can't quite remember what her story is.
Yeah. So she has that weird, like, glassy-eyed look where it looks like she'd, like, you know, was overdosed on NyQuil or something before she started filming her scenes. And judging by the documentary, seems to kind of have that look just naturally in her everyday life. And she's a total recluse, or at least was at the time that the documentary was filmed, you know, because the documentary shows a lot of the cast and crew kind of going to these like revival screenings of the movie or like horror festivals or things like that. And they're kind of trying to gather most of the principal cast together, and they do track her down. But she is just kind of living with her elderly mother, and she's got a sign outside that says something about, you know, like absolutely no trespassers, you know, and they're trying to kind of convince her to, by they, I mean, Michael Stevenson, who played Joshua, and the George Hardy, who played the father in the movie, are trying to convince her to come to some of these things. And she says something about just like how horrified she is to be out like among people. And she seems to have some sort of genuine mental issue of some kind. Not sure exactly what it is.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I think you're right that you can kind of like tell that from the movie, even though Troll 2 obviously came out or was made a long time before the documentary. But still, yeah, I mean, like it's just such a one in a million group of like actors and crew members who made this movie all like coming together to create this like totally bizarre thing. It seems like kind of a weird miracle in a way, you know?
Yeah, I do wonder how she wound up being in it, if she was, you know, that afraid to be around other people, and maybe whatever caused her to feel that way kind of happened afterwards. But yeah, it does seem kind of like miraculous that she wound up in it, considering her social anxiety.
Definitely. Yeah. That's probably a good segue to talk about the production backstory a little bit. And we don't have to spend too long on this section. We kind of already talked about some of this, but Again, the film was funded by Film Mirage, the Italian company that was headed by Joe D'Amato. Originally, it was supposed to be called Goblins, and it was supposed to be a more family-friendly horror film with humor revolving around vegetarian goblins that hated humans' carnivorous tendencies. Vincent, I think maybe you put some put this quote in the notes from Rosella Drudi. Is that right?
I actually put this one in here when I was rewatching the documentary yesterday. I had to pause it a couple of times to write down verbatim a couple of these quotes from the filmmakers. Yeah, Drudi said, this is her quote: "I didn't want to write your typical horror movie, so I came up with a story about trolls who were vegetarians, because at that point in my life, I had friends who'd all become vegetarians, and it pissed me off. So I had the idea of replacing the vampires in the vampire story with vegetarians. It's criticism, a ferocious attack of today's society."
Are you buying that interpretation? Or that, you know, what she says was the intention?
I believe that it was her intention, I suppose.
Yeah.
I don't know that it shows up on screen that way, but
yeah, this will keep coming back up, but I feel like I think she was sincere in critiquing vegetarianism, and I think her husband Fragoso, is that right?
Fragoso, I think.
Fragoso.
But yeah, it's all these Italian names, yeah.
Fragoso, and you see it in the documentary, but I mean, this man sincerely wanted to tell an important story. You know, does it translate? Maybe not. But again, like with maybe with Plan 9 and other quote best worst movies, there is a real urge to get a message across, however misguided it may be.
Yeah. Now, Matt, as a vegetarian, do you feel like this movie kind of put you in your place and made you realize the error of your ways, perhaps?
I did. I ate a double-decker bologna sandwich as soon as the movie was over. So this movie put me on the right track.
Excellent. Excellent.
Right track to the bathroom.
A double-decker bologna sandwich!
It is, you know, I wouldn't say this movie is actually scary or genuinely disturbing or whatever, but it is gross. And all the scenes where people sort of dissolve into the green slime and then the goblins are just shoving the slime into their mouths. If anything, it made me more convinced of my vegetarianism, you know, I know technically it's supposed to be plants in this movie, but I'm that's pretty disgusting. I think I'll stick with vegetables from now on. So I guess maybe it had the opposite intention of what Drudi was trying to get across. For me, anyway.
I'm a full-blown carnivore now. I don't even touch vegetables.
That's fair, yeah. So this movie did work on Vincent, apparently.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, so again, the production was sort of chaotic. It was shot in 1989 in the sort of small town of Morgan, Utah, over the course of 3 weeks. The budget was only $100,000. Much of the cast came from just neighboring communities from close around the city of Morgan. They showed up, a lot of them thinking that they were just going to be cast as extras, like George Hardy, like Frank mentioned before. And then he was cast in one of the lead roles. That actually happened to several of the actors. So I think maybe they, you know, got into a little bit more than they expected by being cast in this movie. Kind of a chaotic production, also because of the language barrier. It was mostly an Italian crew and an English-speaking cast. The cast wanted to ad-lib a little bit and make the dialogue a little bit more believable, but Fragoso was insistent that they read the dialogue verbatim as it appeared in the script, which we can all be thankful for him saying that, because if the actors did ad-lib, we would not have the multiple amazing lines that are spoken throughout this movie.
Yeah, it's such a key component of the production of this movie. Fragoso's domineering attitude as a director, saying, "No, you must read the script verbatim." And the teen actors in the film, they talk about how they were "This isn't how American teenagers talk. So let's try to do it ourselves." And Fragoso said, "No, this is how Americans talk. I know how American teenagers talk." So just indicative of the dysfunction on set here.
Yeah, it's kind of similar to the movie The Room, which also, I'm not sure where the, blanking on his name, but the director and star of that movie, I'm not sure where he's from. He seems Eastern European or something, but it's similar to that, where it just seems like there's a total, just no understanding of how human beings interact with each other and behave, basically, or like at least like a very alien understanding of it. Like,
yeah,
it's very, very bizarre.
I would say that's true of Flesh for Frankenstein as well, which I think maybe I liked a little bit more than you guys did, but that's another sort of, I don't know, it's very different from this movie, but like so bad it's good, like wondrously bizarre movie, I would say. But Troll 2 is on a totally different level for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if we want to keep talking about the script, it was given to the actors on a scene by scene basis. So the actors, like Don Packard legitimately didn't know what he was doing on set. He just showed up and read some lines. Other actors had a similar experience.
I was going to say, like, one of the few scenes that I do remember from Best Worst Movie is when the actors are kind of talking about that, I think, at a screening, and Claudio Fragasso, like, starts yelling at them and says that they're, like, lying dogs and they're making all this up and they knew perfectly well what was going on. So, yeah, so there definitely seems to be some acrimony between Fragasso and the actors, and Fragasso kind of seems like, you know, now he's like, oh, it was totally like an intentionally like exaggerated comedy and like we meant it to be this way the entire time, which, you know, is hard to believe, but I guess it's kind of irrelevant. Like, the finished product is still what it is, and that's amazing.
In the documentary, at one point he has gone to I guess his first like revival screening of it in the United States, and he there's a scene of he and his wife in a hotel room afterwards, and he's just kind of like marveling that people were, he says something to the effect of like, people are laughing at the parts that they're supposed to laugh at, but they're also laughing at the parts that they're not supposed to laugh at. And he seems like genuinely like befuddled about that, and maybe a little bit angry about it too, but yeah, it's one of those things where he's, you can tell he's kind of like trying to like pretend that he's not mad, but you could tell also that he genuinely thinks this was like, you know, a good movie, and, you know, doesn't really understand the reception that it's got him.
Right. And it's such a, both of those things I admire so much. I admire that a filmmaker such as he believes so deeply in this movie, to the point where like his pride is hurt that people laugh at it. But I also admire the fact that people laugh at it, because when you make art, I believe, especially as a writer, the audience is the second half of that. You can write something, but it doesn't matter how you feel about it. The audience is the second half. And I've written plenty of dramatic things that people found wildly funny, and I went, okay, well, I guess, I guess I'm a comedian now, and I didn't even know it.
Can I help you?
Coffee.
There's no coffee here in Ilbog. It's the devil's drink.
Eggs. Bacon.
Are you crazy, boy? We're vegetarians here in Ilbog. Didn't you know that? Here's some Ilbog milk. Special milk. High in vitamin content. Here is free.
Free?
Of course it's free. We love tourists here in Ilbog. Try some, boy. And have some of your friends drink some also.
But yeah, I think it's a good point. I think there's like a lot of sincerity behind the movie, even if it seems like, you know, kind of laughable or preposterous in so many ways. Like, yeah, it's not a cynical movie. Like, you can tell that like the filmmakers were trying to get something across. Vincent, you kind of mentioned that before. But I also think that like the audience response, it doesn't seem mean-spirited to me. Like, it seems like most people that love this movie just like adore its weirdness and like its surreal qualities, you know?
Yeah, the lack of cynicism, I think, is like a real key to its charm, too. And the key to the charm of most of the, you know, so bad they're good styles of movies. Like, you know, it's sort of the opposite of something like like Sharknado or something, which I, to be fair, I've never seen Sharknado, but it, you can kind of tell what it is without having seen it. It's just, this like prefabricated cult movie thing where they're like trying to make something so bad it's good. And that never really works out. But yeah, these movies that they have like a weird sort of like innocence to them. This like weird ragtag group of people were all trying to work toward something that they thought would be good, and it didn't work out that way. But maybe it's more interesting the way it turned out than it would have been if they'd, succeeded at making something more competent.
Yeah, definitely. I feel that way about The Room too, which I'm like, I think there's a lot of sincerity behind that movie as well. Like I like there's a, Tommy Wiseau I think has like a passion for making movies, even if he, in conventional ways is not very good at it. And like when The Disaster Artist came out, that James Franco movie that's about the making of The Room, I remember thinking like I like The Room so much more than The Disaster Artist. Like The Room is sincere and The Disaster Artist is like trying to like capitalize on something that is kind of like a bolt of lightning, like you can't recreate that. So yeah, I mean I think movies like The Room and Troll 2 kind of make us like rethink what the standards of like good or bad movies are, So Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty. Your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services. Follow the Zach Pack on social media and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio. Vincent, I should also ask, do we have anything in Mina's mailbox tonight?
No, except Frank Olson. Let's see, what kind of fun nostalgic question can we ask Frank? What was the earliest movie you can remember renting from the video store?
Ooh, good question. Man, I don't know if I remember the first. I know one that I rented frequently when I was like I don't know, maybe 12 years old or something, and I don't know what this says about me, but is the Terry Gilliam movie Brazil. That was my favorite movie for a while. I rented that all the time. And I'm not, I'm sure I didn't really like understand like a lot of its like social themes and stuff at the time. I think I just thought like the production design was cool and everything, and like the zaniness was interesting. But obviously we did a lot before that. I remember as far as like so bad they're good type movies, I remember my whole family used to watch a lot of the old like Rudy Ray Moore blaxploitation movies like Dolomite, Disco Godfather, Petey Wheatstraw, The Devil's Son-in-Law, and Human Tornado. Those were ones that, again, that we rented like multiple times.
Cool. I haven't seen any of those.
They're definitely experiences. They're real strange. I mean, Dolomite's the most famous one. I think it's, well, the Human Tornado is actually even better. But another one I have like a kind of specific memory of renting is Lost Highway by David Lynch. It came out in 97, so I would have been like 13. I remember I was like trying to scheme of like a way to like get my parents to rent it for me because it was rated R, but also try to plan it out so that I could like watch it when they weren't around because I knew it had like a lot of sex and violence in it. And which it does. It was probably not really appropriate for a 13-year-old, but I'm okay. So yeah, that was another specific video rental memory.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that.
I think it speaks very highly of you, Frank, that your favorite movie to rent when you were 12 years old was Brazil. I don't think that's true of too many 12-year-olds, so it's probably a good one.
Yeah, I mean, I'd already been into like Monty Python, I guess, and Terry Gilliam was in Monty Python, so I guess that was kind of my gateway to it. But yeah, I just like always loved the way it looked and stuff, and I see more flaws in it now. I rewatched it again about 2 years ago, and I still think it's a pretty great movie, but there's definitely, some issues I have with it now that I wouldn't have thought of then. But it's definitely visually fascinating.
All right. Let's talk more Nilbog.
Yeah, back to the wonderful land of Nilbog. What themes are in this movie besides the obvious theme of vegetarians suck?
I will posit the theme of the family. I think this speaks to the innocence of the film and the endearing quality. Like Joshua and his relationship with Grandpa Seth, I find legitimately endearing. And I was like, oh man, I am on their side. Big fan of Joshua and Grandpa Seth.
And I think Claudio Fragasso, the director himself, speaks to this again. This is another one I had to write down verbatim from the documentary. He says, Troll 2 is a film that examines many serious and important issues like eating, living, and dying. It's an important film which talks about the family, the union of the family, resisting all of those things that want to destroy it and see it dead. People want to eat this family. In Italy, we call this a parable.
There you go. Those Italians, I'm telling you.
Well, I do think Italians have like a certain tendency to like leave restraint like far behind, you know, like that's what I love about like so many Italian movies and like, I guess like music, although I don't know like a ton of Italian musicians, I guess, but like, yeah, like subtlety is not their strong point. And I think that's one of the best things about them, you know?
Best thing about Italians, obnoxious AF.
You know, I guess I'm thinking of like filmmakers like Dario Argento, Mario Bava, like Fellini, who are just like, you know, have no restraint whatsoever. I'm not necessarily putting Claudio Fragasso in the same category as them, but you know, there's a certain tendency there.
What are you doing to my son?
We were giving him some ice cream.
But yeah, I love that quote from Fragasso, because like, even if that doesn't totally come across in the movie, yeah, he was trying to say something, so you gotta appreciate that.
What else? I think I must have written down, I must have clutched at some straws and come up with some other themes. Let's see, small towns, druidism. Sort of like the cult aspect of this small town. I don't know. It's shot in Utah. Coincidence? What's up with that? There are no girls in this town. Credence is the goblin queen, but also kind of like the only female character outside of the family.
There is that girl early on who's like running away from the goblins, but we don't really understand anything about her. And then she's almost immediately like dissolved into liquid goo. So I don't know if that totally counts.
Right. So maybe the female is, they're either portrayed as a witch or a subject of sacrifice.
Or like dancing in front of the mirror in that awesome like Garfield t-shirt. That's they're doing those three things. That's all they can do in this movie.
I love Holly, just an unsung hero. She's great.
And you know, like the actress's story outside of this film is also kind of interesting, because she, I'm trying to remember, she was devoutly religious. I can't remember if she was Mormon, but I think she might be, since they're you know, shooting in Utah. But like, she was, you know, kind of uncomfortable with like a lot of the things that she had to do in this movie. This was like the first time she ever kissed anybody. It was like on screen in this film. So she's kind of talked about that a little bit, and you gotta kind of feel for her a little bit, because it must have been a very bizarre experience for her and so many other people in the making of this movie. Anyway, any other themes that we want to talk about in Troll 2?
No.
All right. Fair enough. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know what else there is. And we already kind of talked about the form of the movie a little bit. Frank, I think you're right. It doesn't look bad. Like, there are some scenes that, you know, are like, look pretty striking, I think. Yeah, so that's one good thing you could say about it.
Can we just talk about the makeup effects of the goblins, like those masks? So I watched Troll 2 before I watched Troll 1. And Troll 2, the masks are pretty bad. They look like cheap paper mache or Halloween type clothing. Nothing compared to Troll. I know they're different movies, but the makeup and masks in that movie are legitimately good. But in Troll 2, they just look very cheap, very just roughly put together.
Yes, yeah, definitely. I think, like, you know, there are just so many images in this movie that are impossible to forget. And like, although the masks are like not very high quality and not actually scary, like I still feel like the look of them is like imprinted in my memory and like always will be for the rest of my life.
Oh,
So
yeah.
like, you know, like there are just so many like, you know, also like the scene where Brent is like covered with popcorn and like the whole seduction with the corn on the cob thing. Like just so many images in this movie that are just like, what the hell is going on? This is so bizarre. Like, I will never see anything like this in another movie, which of course is like a huge compliment in a way, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
The makeup effects are very impressive with all the plant stuff. Like you said, Matt, this is a gross movie, and I think that's a testament to the execution of the effects. Like, people have the plants shooting out of their fingernails. The one kid who screams, "Oh my God!" He's like in a pot, and his legs are turning into viney wood stumps. And I'm like, that looks really gnarly and pretty effective.
Yeah, I agree. You know, that poor actor had to like stand in that pot for like 10 hours, like from what I read. I don't know if that's exaggerated at all, but I'm sure it was extremely unpleasant for him. But yeah, it's like, you know, just ideas that are so bizarre, they like kind of work in a way because they're so unique, you know?
Apparently the when the actor was complaining about having to stand there for so long, that's when they kind of added that like face piece part on. I guess it must have already been made, but that's the director says that that's when they put it on him so they could like stop listening to him complain.
Oh, that's great, man. Claudio Fragasso does not seem like the nicest guy in the world, but he made a pretty awesome movie. All right, I think it's time to move on to the good, the bad, and the campy. Vincent, do you want to start off with the good in the movie?
I actually think it's a fairly decent premise in story construction. I feel like the story does make sense to me. What's bonkers is like within that framework, but the framework itself, I think, is pretty compelling. Like we have a family, we have a little boy, he has this relationship with his ghost grandpa, and ghost grandpa's got to protect them from goblins. So sign me up. I think Michael Stevenson as Joshua does a pretty good job, actually, with his performance. Oh, I just think it's a really simple but effective shot when they play with goblins turning into people. It's always like a cutaway, and then the camera cuts back, and now that goblin is a person, and vice versa. I'm just like, yeah, that works. It doesn't need to be more complicated than that.
Yeah, simple but effective.
Yeah. Yeah.
For sure. Frank, what about you? What's in the good category for you?
I think this is a movie where it's uniquely difficult to separate the good, the bad, and the campy because it's all kind of inseparable in my mind. But yeah, it's it's definitely one of a kind. Despite being billed as a sequel to a movie that it's not really related to at all, it is just it yeah, it's just totally unique. Like you were saying, Matt, there's just a ton of like just totally unforgettable imagery in it. And the shoddiness of some of the costumes and sets and things makes the images more unforgettable rather than less. So many like incredible lines of dialogue. My favorite part in the entire movie, the part that always sticks with me, is after Joshua pees on the food when the dad like takes him over his shoulder and he's just like walking him around the house and he says something to the effect of like, "You see what this is? It's called hospitality, and you can't piss on hospitality." And that whole part, and then he goes into his thing about how he's gonna like tighten his belt by one loop so he won't feel hunger pains or something, which is just maybe my favorite example in the movie of just like, people don't talk like this. Like these aren't expressions. This is not how anybody in real life would behave. But it's totally bizarre and totally fascinating. So,
Oh yeah.
yeah.
Joshua pissing on the dining table That's one of the greatest moments in cinema history. I just have to say, like, I'm not even joking. I was covering my eyes in anticipation, like, oh no.
Yeah, that for me is the moment where it goes from being like kind of like amusing and weird into being like a special like oddity. Like,
yeah,
that's where it really goes like fully off the rails.
Yep.
Yeah, totally agree. That's also my favorite scene in the movie. I do want to shout out my second favorite moment in the movie, which is when one of the friends, like one of Elliot's friends, is being driven into town by the sheriff, whose name is Gene Freak, which I just think is very amusing. And then the kid like gets out of the cop car and he says something like, hey, we're like the single liberated girls in this town or something like that. And the sheriff just starts like cackling and like closes the door and drives away like very suddenly. That's another moment that's like, what? No, this is not how any human beings would behave, and I am so glad to be watching this right now.
Oh, and Sheriff, where did the girls from around here go at night?
The girls!
One other thing about like that'll just kind of lump into the good category. I feel like with a lot of so bad it's good movies, there are like boring or dry stretches. Vincent, we just talked about Plan 9 from Outer Space, and I think that's kind of a good example of that. But this movie is so bewilderingly entertaining the entire way through. Like, there is not really like a dry or like dull moment in the entire film, and that takes like a certain kind of skill. Frank, like you said, you know, it's kind of hard to separate the good, the bad, and the campy in this movie, but is there anything in the bad that you guys want to mention?
I did, if I may critique this film, I found the portrayal of Credence the Witch to be so wildly exaggerated in a certain way that felt removed from the rest of the exaggeration of the movie. Like, her performance just seemed a little bit too unhinged in an already unhinged movie that I was like, eh. I don't know. You're trying too hard. Maybe that's it. She's like, I feel like you're just trying too hard. You're okay. You're the crazy witch.
I do kind of get what you mean about her performance. Like, she seems like she, you know, a lot of these people are clearly non-professionals. And, you know, like I was saying, having seen the documentary, a few people just seem like they're just like acting like their own weird selves.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, she seems like someone who maybe like is just like a bad local theater actor or something. Yeah. And she's really, really trying to ham it up. Yeah, I do know what you mean about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's an interesting story just real quick. The guy who plays, I think his name is Alan. He's the one who turns into the tree and he's like in the pot the entire, or, you know, for so long. But he said that he was shooting a scene with her, like the first scene that they shot together. And she started like giving her like very theatrical over the top performance. And that actor, I wish I remembered his name, but I don't. He was like, is somebody going to say cut? Are they really going to let her act like this? And then they just kept on going. So maybe to that point. I don't really have anything to add to the bad category. Like, I just think it's so hard to, yeah, again, like, you know, I think Frank is right that it's hard to like separate the good, the bad, and the campy here. I think, you know, like the twist ending, which again, I won't ruin, like it, in a different movie, it could seem kind of like mean-spirited and like unnecessarily cruel. But like in this movie, they're clearly not real human beings. And like, we're not necessarily taking anything seriously. So I'm kind of okay with it in this case.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really have much to add to the bad category personally.
How about campy?
Oh, the entire thing. I mean, how can you choose just one? You know, I'll just shout out the guy who plays the like the reverend, who like especially like the sermon that he gives about meat and like the dangers of eating meat and all that. Like, that's a very unhinged performance. It's really, really entertaining. I do actually think that like the moment when he like lights on fire, when like the Molotov cocktail that he's holding is like hit by the flash of lightning, is like a decent special effect. I was not expecting that. Anything else in the campy category? I mean, it's kind of hard to isolate.
I just wanted to add when Grandpa Seth appears in the wrong bedroom. Remember, he's got this mirror relationship with Joshua. But they go to this new house and Grandpa Seth appears. I think it's in Holly's room and she sees him for the first time. Anyways, yeah. It's very funny because Grandpa Seth is like, oh, I'm sorry. I don't know the layout of this house yet. I was like, what?
That seems like probably one of those moments that was actually intended to be funny and actually kind of is.
Yeah. But ironically, yeah, it still stands out. Yeah, it's funny.
On the subject of Grandpa Seth, I'll just mention that scene where like they're driving to Nilbog and Joshua thinks that he sees Grandpa Seth at the side of the road. And then, of course, it turns out to be like an unkempt hitchhiker or whatever. I really love that scene, too.
I love the scene where they're in the car on the way to Nilbog. And the mom is like, Joshua, sing your favorite song. And he sings Row, Row, Row Your Boat, which is like a one-line song. Like, there's nothing to that song.
I think the way she phrases it, if I remember correctly, is sing that song I like.
Oh yeah, it's like that,
as if it's like, you know, some like, you know, obscure song that only they share together or whatever.
Row, row, row your boat. It's our special song.
Yeah. That's a memorable moment. Probably her finest moment of acting in the movie too. She looks especially insane in that scene.
All right, I think it's time to get to our ratings. So as always on Camp Kaiju, our ratings are: it is a timeless classic and definitely stands the test of time. Our second rating is: there may be some antiquated moments, but overall it's great and stands the test of time. Number three, it may be historically significant or just fun, but does not stand the test of time. And our lowest ranking, it is not worth revisiting and definitely does not stand the test of time. So as mentioned, this movie kind of throws the notion of like criteria and rankings like into question. But, you know, we have a structure. We have to follow it here on Camp Kaiju. We're very strict. So, Vincent, should we start with you? What do you got?
Yeah, look, I it's tough. I think the repeat watchability of this film is 100% there. So if that's my guiding star, I have to say this movie stands the test of time. There's plenty of antiquated moments. But I want to watch this again. I want to go to a midnight screening with this movie. I want to be a part of the fandom that is Troll 2. I'm fully on board.
Awesome. I love it. I'll just real quick say that I agree with Vincent. This movie does stand the test of time, in my opinion. It's hard to like say that it's like it deserves the top ranking because, like, I don't know. Maybe there's only so much you can love a movie like this, or maybe not. I could be wrong. But yeah, I'm going to agree with Vincent. I'm going to give it the same ranking. Frank, we'll let you have the last word on Troll 2.
I think you guys are cowards, and this is a timeless classic that definitely takes the test of time. So it's a remarkable movie, maybe in mostly ways that are accidental, but it's wonderful. I've seen it. I don't know how many times I've seen it now, but it never fails to be entertaining, like the entire way through. So
damn, I love it. Called out on our own show.
I think Frank has a point.
You're not wrong, Frank.
I'm already second guessing my evaluation here.
I'm second guessing everything.
Yeah. What is art? Yeah, totally. I mean, Troll 2, one of a kind. Check it out if you haven't already seen it. Frank, thank you again for joining us tonight. Always a pleasure to have you on, especially to talk about a movie like this, which is so insane.
Yeah, thanks again for having me.
Thank you. Let's one day we'll get together, the three of us, and screen this movie. I'd love to do that.
But yeah, that would be fun.
That'd be great.
Mm-hmm. Our next Camp Kaiju public screening, Troll 2.
Honestly, I think we would get so many people coming to that.
Especially if you can get Claudio Fragrasso to come in.
I want to meet George Hardy, honestly. Like, I love that man.
He seems like a nice guy. Yeah.
I think Don Packard is the person that I would want to invite most of all, although I'd be a little bit worried about that. But
maybe not to like stay at your house or anything, but yeah.
Yeah,
exactly, yeah. All right, well, thank you all for hanging out. If you liked what you hear, please tell a friend, leave a rating and review, and visit campkaijumoviereviews.com or Instagram for more monster movie content. we can't thank you enough. Camp Kaiju was recorded in Minneapolis, St. Paul, with theme music by Terrence Jackson and Mina's Mailbox by Ben Cook Feltz. Camp Kaiju is sponsored by Zach Linder and the Zach Pack, powered by Coldwell Banker Realty, your source for real estate, home rehab, fixing and flipping for investor clients, and residential buyers. Reach out to the Zach Pack today for real estate services, follow the Zach Pack on social media, and contact the Zach Pack for investment opportunities. Links in the bio.
Do you see this writing? Do you know what it means? Hospitality. And you can't piss on hospitality. I won't allow it!
What are you going to do to me, Daddy?
Tighten my belt by one loop so I don't feel hunger pains. And your sister and mother will have to do likewise. Okay, Joshua. You want to get rough with me? You want to show me that you don't like the choice of this house for our vacation by going on a hunger strike? Well, I'll accept the challenge. But just remember, when I was your age, I really did suffer from hunger. We'll see who gets through this. But just remember, I've got more practice than you. I'll see you tomorrow.
Cool. Well, yeah, Vincent, what was the first movie that you remember renting at the video store?
Gamera movies. I remember.
Oh, nice.
I must have been like 4 or 5. Like, literally my earliest memories are going into some video store. We lived in the mountains of North Carolina at the time. And I just wanted a Gamera movie.
Very on brand.
Yeah, I know. It just, who knew what my life would become?
your future was set from that point on. I'll just say real quick, I remember I went to a video store in Montello, Wisconsin with my family when I was like six or seven maybe, and I must have been a little bit older, because I really wanted to rent the movie Dumb and Dumber, and my parents thought that it was going to be inappropriate, so they wouldn't let me rent it. So we got the movie Charade instead, with Cary Grant and Audrey Hepburn. And at first I was really upset. I was like, this is an old movie, it's going to be stupid and boring. And then we watched it, and I loved it. Still love that movie very much. And I feel like that was a formative experience for me. It was one of the first times that I was like, wow, old movies are great. I need to watch more of these.
All right. One more. I had the same experience with Singing in the Rain. I was a bratty teenage boy. And my mom was like, sit down and watch this movie with me. I was like, no way. It's like a musical. It's a girly, blah, blah. I don't want to watch that. And now I've seen it a million times.
All-time classic. Yeah, irresistible.
Yeah.
That probably is like maybe the best movie for people that are like resistant to classic movies, because it's so entertaining and like funny and looks great. Like, it's just impossible to resist that movie, you know?
Such was the case with me.
No more popcorn.